Hello and welcome aboard your Easter edition of the Maritime Programme Seascapes. This week, the final instalment in our conversation with Gerald Butler. And we'll have the winners of those copies of The Lightkeeper, courtesy of IrishBooksDirect.ie. David Dinsmore has the latest on the April edition of Irish Angler. Suzanne Campion of Inland Fisheries Ireland talks to Seascapes about that proposed deep sea fish farm in Galway Bay. First, on Seascapes this week, we take to the waterways and hear from Colin Becker.
Well, it's that time of year to dewinterise the old engine, blow the cobwebs off the life jackets and get out on the water again. Actually, speaking of life jackets, can I repeat the usual start of season plea? Don't just blow the cobwebs off those life jackets. Check them thoroughly. And if you're at all unsure about what you're checking for, get them checked professionally. In the past, I've been involved in spot checks on life jacket safety, and the number of jackets that fail to come up to scratch is actually quite disturbing. Discharged gas bottles, torn bladders, badly worn straps and lots of other faults are all too common. Our association is planning about 250 events on and around the waterways this year, ranging from small boat rallies to work parties to major events like the annual Lough Erne, Lough Derg and Shannon boat rallies. Our Kildare branch are holding their annual rally at Robertstown over the Easter weekend. And on Saturday, April the 13th, our Lough Derg branch are hosting a talk by Pat and Olivia Murphy on their round-the-world sailing exploits. That talk will be in the Village Hall Terryglass at about 8:30 p.m. And that same weekend, our powerboat branch are starting the season off in style with a visit to the town and port of Drogheda and the River Boyne, with 20 or more boats coming from all over the country. At around 12:45 on Saturday, April 13th, Dennis Moynihan, chairman of Drogheda Port Company, and the mayor, Paul Bell, will welcome the boats when they berth near De Lacy Bridge. The fleet will be accompanied by the Drogheda Port pilot boats, the Clarehead RNLI lifeboat and the river rescue boats. The following day, the fleet will travel to the sea lock at Old Bridge to see progress on the IWAI Boyne Navigation Branch project and also go for a tour of the Battle of the Boyne site. Waterways Ireland have informed us the dredging on the circular line of the Grand Canal in Dublin is now complete, and they've also issued details of when they plan to open the so-called Effin Bridge on the Royal Canal. That's the railway bridge at Newcomen Junction near the North Strand that allows passage to and from Spencer Dock and the Liffey. The first lifts of the season are planned for April 16th and 30th, but as was the case previously, you must call them in advance to let them know you're coming. You can't just turn up on the day. And finally, a reminder to all our own members that the IWAI AGM takes place in the Mullingar Park Hotel on Friday the 26th of April at 8 p.m. As usual, if you'd like further information about any of these topics or about our waterways in general, you can call me, Colin Becker, on our low-call number 1890 924 991, and of course there's further details on our website www.iwai.ie. And that's all from the Inland Waterways until next time here on Seascapes.
Next here on Seascapes, to Clonmel on the banks of the River Shure, and to Suzanne Campion, Head of Business Development with Inland Fisheries Ireland. We talked to Suzanne about Inland Fisheries Ireland's view of the proposed Bord Iasca Uaire fish farm planned for Galway Bay.
Inland Fisheries Ireland supports sustainable aquaculture. We're all for it once it's properly stewarded, once it has all the right protocols in place, and we're there to help and advise in any way we can so that the sustainable exploitation of all the resources around the country can be best used to get a better return for Ireland. Well, the value of fish stocks, we're putting a value in terms of recreational angling on them at the moment. We have a survey of recreational angling which is about to be completed, and we will shortly have the report. In terms of what we do with Chagascan farmers, IFI staff have been training the Chagascan advisors, who in turn have been training the farmers, and with the REP scheme and all the other best agricultural practice, water quality in rivers has been improving an awful lot over the last number of years. That is IFI's, whole modus of operandi now. We have a lot less resources in terms of staff and money, and we're all about going out there to facilitate stakeholders to help themselves. So we will advise, we will give how-to guides and so on, so that people can best manage the resources that we have, whether they be in rivers, lakes or, you know, inshore areas. It's estimated at the moment, following the survey that we're doing, that we have over 400,000 anglers fishing in Ireland every year. About 250,000 of those are Irish, 40,000 are from Northern Ireland, and the remainder are from overseas. The value that they bring to the country is estimated to be in excess of 500 million, which is an enormous amount of money. In terms of sea angling, 97,000 of the over 400,000 fishermen say they have sea angled in Ireland. So while they might not be their first love of, in angling, may not be sea angling, there are 97,000 of them that practice it. It's a huge, huge income into the state every year. And if you look at, say, reports done by the NUIG in Galway in relation to peripheral and isolated incomes coming in the west of Ireland, they estimate that if you get in 1 million through water-based activities, that it's worth 1.5 million to local and rural communities. It doesn't get exported outside of the country. It's all into the pockets of local people.
So what kind of view does the IFI take of this proposed fish farm project? It's a massive, in terms of scale, we're hearing that it's rather massive. I know there's a great deal of concern amongst anglers. We've certainly seen by the recent gathering in Galway where so many different organisations were represented. There's great concern about this whole development.
Well, definitely there's great concern, and I suppose in every town and county and country part of Ireland there's an angling club, and they are all very concerned about this, so we hear in through our different blogs and social media. But in terms of IFI's position, IFI supports sustainable aquaculture. We're there, again, as I said earlier, to help and advise and look at the best ways of protecting the wild stocks. That's our remit, after all: conserve, protect, manage, develop and promote in inland fisheries and the sea angling resource. Every science report has its basis in fact, and they're looking at different sets of information and doing their analysis and coming up with results, and they report on those results. In terms of the Marine Institute paper, where they said they were getting 1% mortality, that's 1% to 5%, which in effect is 20%. The previous paper by Inland Fisheries Ireland was, it's a very hard word to say, Cryosec paper, I think it's called, that's how you pronounce it, and it was saying there's 39% mortality from smolts. Recently, there's been even more information coming out on that, and if you look at the Atlantic Salmon Trust website, they've gone through both papers and they have said that the Inland Fisheries Ireland paper is more appropriate because it deals with smolts coming in the way of fish farms, whereas some of the smolts in the Marine Institute paper aren't quite as appropriate to the study and to what they're trying to assess. So I suppose the best thing to do would be to look at the Atlantic Salmon Trust's paper as opposed to take my word for it. But recently, I suppose, if we look at the thing of sea lice, international research from Ireland and Norway indicates that 39% of salmon mortalities are attributable to sea lice. And this is likely acquired during early marine migration in areas with salmon farms. So that's specifically related to salmon farms. There would probably be an awful lot less lice if there wasn't a salmon farm.
So what about depth? Because that's one of the misnomers as well. People are kind of in a bit of a quandary about deep water. What constitutes deep water? Is it 10 metres? Is it 30 metres? Is it 50 metres?
I was interested in that one myself, Marcus, and I had to get, you know, the definition of deep water, and I understand it to be over 200 metres deep is deep sea. Before that, it's not deep sea, but I suppose Inland Fisheries Ireland have acknowledged that moving fish farms away from shallow bays and mouths of rivers is a step in the right direction, and this fish farm is going to be, I think, in 40 metres of water, you know, around that, around the islands. So I don't think it constitutes as deep sea, just probably deeper water. And if you consider that the depths of the nets are about 20 metres, I believe, so if there was a low water level, there wouldn't be much room beneath them. But I'm not, you know, an expert in that area. But it, as far as I know, technically it's not deep sea, but it is deeper water. It's up to everybody in Ireland to be concerned about the resource and harm that might come to it. We have responsibilities under the Habitats Directive, and IFI's submission too on the EIS for the fish farm, you know, denotes all the different areas for concern, and we set out a roadmap basically of what can be done to address those concerns. So we believe sustainable aquaculture is possible, and there's an awful lot that can be done to make it so. The fish farm proposal as it stands, you know, is going through a procedure. The minister has tasked BIM with bringing it through the procedure, and he has his department I think, assessing 410 submissions at the moment. And he, you know, is holding himself separate and will make a decision on that, which I'm sure will issue shortly.
Suzanne Campion of Inland Fisheries Ireland. A new record has been set by the Dublin Angling Initiative with Eric Cahill, 16 years old, catching a fish of a lifetime, a 12-pound record ferox trout from Loch Raymore in Virginia in County Cavan. This is the biggest fish ever caught by a youngster out fishing with the Dublin Angling Initiative. A fishing trip for a group of 10 youngsters was organised for Mulhuddert Feroiga Fishing Club to Loch Raymore, Virginia, by Des Chu of the Dublin Angling Initiative in March. Following an introduction by Des on the setting up of rods, rigs and bait presentation, the youngsters were soon fishing for roach, hybrids and perch, with others choosing to fish for pike. Great fun was being had by the group, who caught and released a lot of coarse fish. Now on Seascapes to our final instalment from Gerald Butler, author of The Lightkeeper, this week on the beauty and majesty of Inis Tearra and the Skelligs.
The sea is such a strange element. It can be savage at one stage and absolutely fantastic in another way. Yeah, you had all this bird life and marine life to look at. The seals alone were fascinating. I remember on the Bull Rock, I went down fishing one around just before lunchtime. It was a beautiful sunny day, and I climbed down to the landing, and I saw a seal just in the water off the landing. And I said to myself, well, there's not much point in me throwing in my gear, because any fish, he'll have it. So I whistled, and of course they're extremely curious creatures, and the seal just kept looking at me. And after a while, I think I got fed up, and I went back up home to the kitchen. And the following day, I went down again. There was the seal sitting in the water the second day, and I whistled and kept him occupied for a while. And the third day, he was there again. And at the same time, the seal was there every day for quite a while after. And I thought that was, we were building some kind of a relationship. But it was, yeah, the nature of the world around us that out in those places is just fantastic, I have to say. I often thought what would give those their part of their specialness would be, firstly, they were never capped with ice during the Ice Age, or at least that's what an archaeologist explained to me. And it made those two rocks very interesting. As you know, on Skelligs, it was the monks lived there. It was a monastery. And Inis Tearra as well, they're huge, big rocks, up about 700 feet high. And I'm not rightly sure what the acreage at sea level is, but there's a huge acreage on them. And, of course, it's all rock. A lot of vegetation, a lot of very black soil, and it was very good for growing, for keeping a garden. It was home to a huge amount of rabbits. Inis Tearra, some keepers over the years brought out goats, and of course it was very good for goats, but then inbreeding caused, they had to be put down, and that had to be changed. But it was very suitable for that. If it was properly managed, it would be a lovely pastime. It was also home to millions of rabbits because of the pockets of soil that they were able to burrow into. There was a tremendous amount of vegetation, a lot of oily leafed vegetation, and of course this proved fantastic for these creatures. We kept a garden on Inis Tearra, and I remember we had to get out coils of chain link fencing and bury it, some of it down underneath the walls of the garden, to stop the rabbits burrowing under the wall to get in. So when they'd burrow down, they'd hit the wire. And so because of that, we were able to have our garden on Inis Tearra. It was fantastic, because it was great to have the fresh vegetables for dinner and etc. These rocks were fantastic places for climbing. Extremely dangerous, but nonetheless, they were fantastic for climbing. And I used to spend a lot of time climbing and exploring the rocks. In Ishtirat, I made a weather vane and I erected it at the very summit of the rock up on the peak. Even to put it there took an entire day from the crack of dawn until almost sunset before I had it dragged up, erected and back down again. That weather vane lasted for 10 years. I made it in the workshop out of scraps and out of engines that had been decommissioned and broken up. And it was very good for the pilots landing the helicopter. They were able to, as they come near the rock, they were able to get a true direction of the wind. I remember when you'd be coming in to land the helicopter just in the final stages, it would vibrate so violently inside it that you would think the nuts and bolts holding the helicopter together were going to come adrift. Indeed, at one stage, that did happen, and the pilot, an alarm went off, and the pilot managed to land the helicopter on Mount Brandon, just brought it ashore and landed it on Mount Brandon until technicians came down and carried out repairs. The updrafts are unbelievable. You could stand on the pad, you could light a match and the match would burn straight down and burn your fingers without blowing out. And yet if you stood at the very edge of the pad, there would be a rip-roaring gale of wind. And of course, as the wind was rising, it was sucking the air off the pad. And that would make the pad extremely calm, but just go maybe 1 foot or 2 foot out off the pad and it was a different story. So to negotiate all that, the pilots had to develop a great skill at landing on it. And I remember landing on the Bull Rock off the Dursey Island. I was in the back of the helicopter. There was another keeper up in the front of it beside the pilot. And when the pilot was bringing the helicopter in, the pilot, the ideal way he had been telling us is to almost land it like an aeroplane, keep it nearly at the same level as the pad and just touch down onto the pad. So he got caught in this cam on top of the pad, and just as he wanted to put the helicopter on the pad, the rotors were sticking out and they were catching this severe updraft. So put the pilot in a very difficult position. He could not put the chopper on the pad. So he had to go out off the pad into the wind and fly right down the face of the cliff. And I remember being inside and you just look out the front window and you see the water rushing at you at 90 to 100 miles an hour. And when the pilot got down near the bottom, of course, he had the controls, he knew what he was doing. He flew the chopper back out. He had enough wind under him and he was able to fly out over the sea. Back up he came again and tried the same thing a second time. Found himself in the exact same difficulty. And I felt at that stage we could have said to the pilot, don't do this anymore, go home. But the day was really not a day to cancel a relief. However, he decided to do it the third time and he was hovering at about maybe 5 feet over the pad and the vibrations inside in the chopper were something terrible. So what holds the helicopter up is a thing like the handbrake in the car. When you pull it up, you increase the pitch on the rotor. When you drop it down, you decrease the pitch. And that's what puts the chopper on the pad. So he was holding this thing in his hand and he sort of said, to hell with it, I'm going to drop it. Lost the pitch on the rotors. And instead of the helicopter coming straight down, because of the updraft and because it was a saucer-like disc up over us, it seesawed its way down onto the pad. And at touchdown, the skid on the right-hand side barely caught the edge of the pad. And of course, at that point, if anything, if it had been another 4 inches, the chopper would have tumbled sideways because the pilot, he was out of control at that stage, you know. And this is how the lads learned. They became very, very, very skilled at landing on the rocks. We developed a great trust in them and we had a great relationship with all of those. Skelligs and Inishtirat are very spiritual places. Skelligs, again, of course, as we know about the monastery up on the top of it where the monks lived, and often a priest would come out to the rock, even now in these times, and offer Holy Sacrifice, the Mass, up in some in the cells. Duchess, or they are back now, I think, to OPW. They have restored a lot of those, because the stones on these cells are just dry stone buildings. A lot of the stones were falling away, and they built them back up again. And the cells are. They're lovely to see how they're done, and even to be inside them. You'd feel the wind coming through the walls of it. I don't know how the monks lived in it. I have absolutely no idea. But of course, I suppose there were a hardier people back then than what we were now.
So do you miss it?
I do miss it to a certain extent. I miss the physicality of it. But I do give lectures on the Irish Lights, and I keep myself abreast of everything doing that. When I left, I missed it very, very much, because what I missed most of all was the amount of time that I had. I didn't realise, even though I suppose in a way I subconsciously did, but I had taken perhaps time for granted. Now, I did make a lot of things and I enjoyed doing creative work and etc. But when I left, the first thing I realised was I had to earn a living, and that meant getting out and doing something. I became a fisherman, and it was a total contrast. While I was fishing, I gave 10 years as a fisherman, and there was never a day under 18 hours. Some went to the 24 and beyond. So I missed it, yeah, no doubt I did. But I've been lucky enough. Got a part-time job with the Irish Lights as the attendant keeper at the Galley Head, which was our homestead after my mother and father had retired from it. And I love it. I absolutely love the involvement and looking after it and etc., you know.
Gerald Butler and his book, The Lightkeeper, is published, as you answered, by the Liffey Press. Many thanks for all your entries by email and postcard. The winners who receive a copy of the book, courtesy of IrishBooksDirect.ie, are Mary Newell of Lucan, John Morgan in Massachusetts, Andrew Wilkes in Dungarvan, and Anne Doyle in Arklow. From the 4th to the 7th of April, Lough Derg Yachtclub in Drumineer in County Tipperary will be the host venue for the most prestigious annual youth sailing event on the domestic calendar. All of the ISA Performance Pathway classes will be represented, and up for grabs will be the coveted places on summer squads and teams for international events. Conflicts in this country over how to best use natural resources, from oil and gas extraction to wind and fish farms, continue to make headlines. A new book from researchers with the Ryan Institute at the National University of Ireland in Galway, titled Methods of Sustainability Research for the Social Sciences, and offers fresh insights into how to understand local conflicts over natural resources and their connections with sustainable or unsustainable development. More from NUI Galway. Next, here on Seascapes, to the west of Ireland and to Castlebar, where we hear from David Dinsmore, editor of Irish Angler, on what's in next month's edition of the Angling magazine.
This month's magazine, we've got a very packed issue as usual, 100 pages, covering game, sea and coarse angling throughout the island, and we even go slightly further afield this month to Iceland. And we have a very exciting development in terms of new technology that we're introducing for the first time. We're the first fishing magazine in the world to use it. They had a first salmon the other day on Carra Mór, so it's gradually starting. The rivers, after not having too much rain, we're gradually starting to get into it now. So hopefully, if the temperatures pick up a bit, we should start to see a few more fish coming off. So that's really what we're hoping for over the next few weeks.
What's this new development that you can tell us about?
It's called Augmented Reality, and we're the first fishing magazine in the world to introduce it. Basically, it sort of bridges the gap between print and online, and essentially it brings a magazine to life. You download the app, it's called Orasma. And once it's loaded up on your smartphone, there are instructions in this month's magazine. You basically point your phone at an image, for in the magazine, for example, if you point it at the cover, you'll see a little video of me telling you what's inside the magazine. And we also have a new knot, top salmon guide, Paddy McDonald. It has a video showing you how to tie a new knot. And Martin McGowan will demonstrate how to prepare a peeler crab for use. And Jim Clohesy is lure fishing for bass. And you can see all of those videos simply by pointing your phone at the relevant image in the magazine. And that's something that we're introducing for the first time, and we'll be rolling out. Hopefully most of our articles will have an element of this in the very near future. It's a completely free app. You can download it for free either on an Apple or an Android phone. And once you have it downloaded, there's lots of other stuff. More and more magazines are starting to use it. But as I said, we're the first fishing magazine.
On the 18th of April, the Space Innovation Powering Blue Growth Conference will take place in the National Maritime College of Ireland in Cork. The conference is an associated event of the Irish Presidency of the Council of the European Union and is jointly organised by Enterprise Ireland, the Coastal and Marine Research Centre, the Irish Coast Guard, the Irish Naval Service and DG Maritime Affairs and ESA. Further details, including the conference programme, registration and so on, can be accessed from the following website: www.congrexprojects.com. That's www.congrexprojects.com. There'll be no Seascapes next week or the following week. Seascapes returns on the 19th of April with a special featuring Sea Scouts who last year celebrated their centenary. Until then, don't forget to check that life jacket, tight lines, and fair sailing.